Coming up on Broadway Radio, a special series of interviews with the creators of theatrically themed podcasts. In our fourth interview of the series, we talk with Nick Hudson of the Musical Talk podcast in London. Please stay tuned. With us today, we have a very special guest. Nick Hudson is joining us from the Musical Talk podcast, which originates over in the UK. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you for wanting to talk to me. It's an absolute pleasure to be on the other side of the microphone, as it were.
Yeah, it's kind of been the strange experience for the folks in other podcasts who I've interviewed, and they're like, wow, I don't know what's coming next.
So. I'm a celebrity.
So tell us about the Musical Talk podcast. You know, tell us what it is.
Well, Musical Talk is, I like to think of it as the UK's largest and possibly best musical theatre podcast. Mm-hmm. Because when I was younger, I always wanted to be a radio presenter. It seemed at the time like the best job in the world. You know, you get paid to listen to music and air your thoughts to tens of people. And now with the advent of podcasting and, you know, anyone with a microphone can air their opinions. And I thought, there's nothing in the UK doing this. And I've always loved musicals and stuff. So I thought, why don't I do it? So my friend of mine called Andrew Edwards and I started Musical Talk back in 2006.
Now, 2006, you're coming up on 10 years. And, you know, podcasts, at least in America, have become kind of mainstream in the last 2 years. I've been involved in podcasts for about 10 years or so. But how is your audience development in the UK and all across Europe? And I mean, 2006, you must have had low numbers for a bunch of years until it caught on.
Well, I never paid a huge amount of attention to the listeners and where we were getting our listeners from, because I've always had the thought process that you should do the same show as if it's for one person, as if it were for 20 million people. You always got to give the best quality you can, no matter how many people are listening. You can't force people to listen to this stuff because it's a niche market within a niche market, I think. So we were lucky in the fact that I was able to bag Stephen Schwartz to be in our second episode. Mm-hmm. So that put us on the map immediately, I think, and it gave us credibility to, from very early on, get some pretty good guests. So we were able to be a pretty prominent voice in the musical theatre world from the beginning. Does that answer your question? I can't remember.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Stephen Schwartz, how did you land Stephen Schwartz on your second show?
He and I have been emailing back and forth because I was a precocious young person and I wrote him an email and he's always been very good at replying to emails and stuff. That's what I admired about him. And Wicked was just opening in London at the time. It was September 2006, and I remember that well. So Wicked will always be the same age as my podcast in London. And I had somehow bagged a morning with him to go, because I'm a composer and lyricist myself, so I wanted to meet him and stuff. And I managed to bag a morning with him. We drove around London. We sat down and had a drink. And I said, I've just started a little podcast. You wouldn't want to be interviewed for it, would you? And he went, yeah, sure. So, and that's how that came about.
Great story.
Yeah, well, I guess a mixture of luck and precociousness sums up podcast development, really.
You know, you can't get a yes if you don't ask.
Exactly. That's always been my theory as well.
All right. So what, you know, tell me about, you know, what are you doing? What's your individual role on Musical Talk? You know, are you doing everything, or have you been able to parse out some of the other tasks to other members, or?
Well, I've always been there from day one. As I said, I started it with my friend Andrew, and it was just the two of us for a couple of, I guess, 20 weeks or something like that. He would come to my house once a week and he'd say, what do you want to talk about today? And I'd say, I don't know, lighting. We do an episode about lighting and we put it out. And then I met a lovely chap called Thomas Ribbits, who is still doing the podcast. Now, the way we do it now is because the workload just got too much for me, as anyone who does a podcast will attest. So what we do, which is quite unique, is we give our listeners two shows for the price of, well, I would say for the price of one, but it's two shows for the price of nothing, which I'm sure lots of other podcast people will understand as well. He does his own shows. He does his own interviews. He does his own, he has his own theme tune, and I do my own show and my own interviews. And we sometimes cross over. We will meet once every couple of months and do an episode together. But I like the stuff he hates, and he, hates the stuff I like, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So he's all about the dead and gone composers like Gilbert and Sullivan and stuff, and I'm, you know, I like the kind of more up-to-date spectacles. So the way that works is really great, because we give our listeners everything.
Yeah.
Such and he has his own pool of presenters that he can grab from, and I have my own pool of presenters that I can grab from. So no episode is going to be the same. It's never going to be just the two of us talking. And I think that's interesting, because that's how it started out. It was two people, but now we have sort of 15 people that we can grab whenever we want. And people send me, you know, a friend of mine will say, I've just been to see this show. I've recorded a 10-minute chat about it. Here it is. Put it in an episode whenever you want. So that's nice. I'm always getting stuff. But I like to be, I am a co-presenter, producer, talent wrangler, editor, PR person, Facebook, Twitter, you know, it's a task of love, but I love doing it.
Excellent. Well, you had mentioned you have all these folks who have come to you and are brought into the fold under Musical Talk. I noticed that you are not limiting yourself to just West End. In fact, you had a handful of shows that were based upon the newest things that were opening in New York, including The Visit on the 20th Century, Something Rotten, and a handful of other things. So is your audience asking you to go far beyond the West End?
Well, the people that went to see that are, fun enough, my writing partner and his partner, they go to New York once every 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. So I do a lot of stuff with Robert now, episode discussion. He actually taught me my master's at Goldsmiths in musical theatre writing, so he really knows his stuff. Yeah. So that's how I got them on to talk about those shows. We don't tend to do Broadway a huge amount, for obvious reasons, because it's very far away and more expensive than it should be, but that's another topic entirely. We like to focus more on the London stuff, but we'll delve into Broadway's Pandora's box whenever we can to talk about the big new shows that are coming, and especially things like Finding Neverland, which has a British connection with Gary Barlow and things like that. We like to focus on the British attitude towards the Broadway stuff, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. Sure. It was interesting because on our broadcast, Michael, Peter, and I had discussed about Something Rotten and how it might transfer over to London and how it would be received. Mm. And then you guys had talked about it in a show a few weeks ago about how it may be received over in London. And I thought that was interesting. I find there's a lot of parallels between This Week on Broadway with Peter, Felicia, and Michael Portantier and me, and your podcast, Musical Talk, as well. It's sort of you're our partners in crime on the other side.
the transatlantic cousin.
Yes, exactly. So how you mentioned you started in 2006. Do you know how many actual shows you've released?
Oh, good God.
I think that it was along the lines of 500 when I counted, when I saw it was at least in your feed.
Well, we do probably, yeah. I mean, I just put out episode 442 this week, and we've probably done about 30 minis and some episodes. So probably we're coming up to 500, which is terrifying but wonderful.
That is great. And folks can, if our listeners wanted to go back and search through your archives, is it possible to do that?
Yes. They can find us on iTunes, but it only goes down to episode number 23. We had some feed issues.
Yeah.
But if you go to our website, we are going to change this domain because it's a bit silly, but it's musicaltalkpodcast.weebly.com. You can go through all the episodes are there, but as always, the earlier ones are pretty more hilarious than they should be. But it's what I love about going back and listening is we are documenting history here. I mean, it's not history, it's the development of an art form, but we get excited about some shows which don't last. We poo-poo some shows which then go on to become huge hits. We've interviewed people that I would never ever dream of meeting ever. And that's what I'm really proud of about this is my contact book and my networking, and the fact that we are able to have this huge archive of, you know, Jerry Herman and Stephen Sondheim and many, many Alan Menken interviews and people you've never heard of, like casting directors in this country, or a good friend of mine, my very dear friend, orchestrator William David Brown. It's very hard to find hour-long discussions with these people. And that's what I'm most proud of doing with Musical Talk.
What's your schedule like? Are you...
My schedule?
Yes.
Once a week we tend to do, but there comes a time when I think you probably just should sit back and say, I will release an episode whenever I can, because it's hard to put something out every week. But every Tuesday we put something out, whether it's a 2.5-hour episode, whether it's a 10-minute discussion. We like to have something out every Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. And you touched on it a little bit, but tell us about your life outside of the podcast. You're a writer, arranger, composer.
Yes, I'm a composer at heart, and I like to think of myself as a lyricist, but who doesn't? I've written a musical which is going to be workshopped at a very, very prestigious drama school near me, whose president is Andrew Lloyd Webber, which is very exciting. And hopefully we're going to get funding from the Cameron McIntosh Foundation for that show. I also teach. I teach at Saturday mornings at a theatre school also near me. We're trialing a kids musical that I've written as well. I'm very much into writing family shows because I think that's the best market in the world that you can write for, because you're not limiting anyone. I also do a theme park podcast. Theme parks are another huge passion of mine, so I'm able to spread my love of the two things I love most by doing podcasts about them, which is great because, like Musical Talk, I get to meet all the creative people in the theme park world as well. And I've just actually, it's previewing at the moment. I mean, I've always agreed that theme parks and theatres are the same thing, effectively. A good theme park will always borrow from theatre, whether it's set design, music, you know, look at the Sherman Brothers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I've just scored the world's first interactive Ghostbusters attraction that is currently previewing at Six Flags in Mexico, of all places, which is very exciting. So I'm constantly doing music for different projects. I got a show playing every Friday night at the world-famous Café de Paris in London's West End, which I scored entirely and arranged and wrote lyrics for with the guy who created the show, my dear friend Ruben Kay. And we're going to be doing their next show as well at the Café de Paris. So bits and pieces here and there, but I also... My day job is I go to people's homes and I help them with their computer equipment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's learning music tech at university has opened up so many worlds to me, because it's really, you've got to be a tech guy to do a podcast, haven't you? good podcast.
There has to be a little bit of technology in everybody who is pressing record on these things.
Yeah. Sadly, it's not very evident in a lot of podcasts.
All right. So what do you have any specific goals for Musical Talk insofar as the podcast goes? You
just to reach episode 500? That's my goal at the moment. No, I'm very happy with the way Musical Talk has gone. I think if you're going to start talking about podcasts, the goal at this point is how can we make some money from it?
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I've met every single person in the world I could ever wish to meet. I've made, I guess, 90% of my friends are from the podcast, whether they started out as listeners or whether they're people we've met at the theater who, you know, do recognize me, which is great. The goal is to keep it going because it's great fun for me and it's hopefully great fun for the listeners. And I get to talk about musicals, and who doesn't like that?
The publicists on the West End, are they embracing of the podcast?
Yes, I'm very lucky to be in with most of the theatre publicists in the West End, and they. I don't get to go to many big grand opening nights, but I'm always at, you know, I'm always able to go and review shows, and they're very, very good about helping us out in that, whether it's getting us guests or getting us review tickets. It's they're very embracing. What are they like on Broadway? Because the times I tried to email, I remember I was going to New York and I wanted to see the Addams Family, and unfortunately I did, but I tried to call out to the publicist and just heard nothing. But you know, how do you find them in New York, if you're allowed to say?
The thing with the publicists in New York is that in order to get press tickets for Broadway shows and some larger off-Broadway shows, you have to be on a list, and right. There are two lists. There's the first night list. Where the reviewers get to review, get invited to shows a couple of days before opening night. And then there's the second night list where reviewers are invited after the show has opened. So a couple of days after the show has opened.
That's the kind of one I go to.
Yeah. And the first night list is very tightly controlled and exclusive. And it's very hard to get on that. Well, it's hard to get on both lists. But the first night list is a very prestigious thing that is reserved for major publications. And the power, the people who the publicists believe that the that are these reviewers are influential in the theater community, more influential than the second night list. And that list is controlled by the Broadway League. So if you're not on the first and the second night list, it's very difficult to get press tickets for anything on a one-off type of thing. If you were looking to do that, you'd have to apply to the league for second night credentials. And then start a relationship up with the press reps. And there's, you know, four or five major press reps on Broadway that handle all the 35 shows or so. So it's really not that much repetitive work. It's not that you have to do it 30 times or something like that. But it is a process, and they don't even respond to most things if you're not on the list because of just the sheer number of requests that they get.
And do you think that'll... I'm interviewing you now, but do you think that'll change because of things like YouTube? And are they aware of the podcast phenomenon?
I think it will change, and I think it's going to change for the worse, because they were very lenient in the past years with bloggers and people who had smaller websites. And it's becoming more and more tightly controlled because it's really a cost factor. The producers are like, why are we giving away so many free tickets to Joe Schmo, who has four readers on his blog? So they're getting tighter. But with the expansion of YouTube channels and various different types of media, I think it might shift a little bit. But they did clamp down a couple of years ago really heavily on the first night list and move people to the second night list. And then people on the second night list fell off in some cases. So it's a constantly discussed thing, especially over the summer. Now that the Tony Awards have happened, the league will go and review the first and second night lists again, and in consultation with various press representatives, add people and cut people to it. And we'll see what has happened there. In many cases, if you took musical talk and joined an organization like the Drama Desk here in the States, you might have an easier way of scoring press tickets on your periodic trips here.
Hmm. Certainly, I'll look into that. I mean, it's fascinating, especially now with Spotify talking about dealing with podcasts. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to open it up to a much bigger
audience. We've been on Spotify for many years, and it's interesting that Spotify made an official announcement about podcasts joining the Spotify realm, that they're going to promote them a little bit better. I think that the podcasting universe is going to change, especially with major media industries.
Right, Serial and things.
Getting into it and spending a lot of money and having literally $1 million budgets to put out a podcast. Just like YouTube changed. YouTube used to be anybody with a camera could be featured on YouTube, and now it's multi-million-dollar shoots for YouTube.
Mm. And the BBC have been doing podcasts for years. And
I listen to the BBC podcast because it's really the only way I can get good American news is through the BBC. It's unbelievable.
And incredibly ironic.
So what inspired you to start podcasting, and what kind of podcast do you listen to?
When I was younger, I wanted to be a radio presenter, and I used to do fake radio shows in my room. You know, I used to do everything from the very young days of having a dictaphone, and I used to have my dad's vinyl player, and I used to say, "Now we're going to hear the Eagles with Desperado," and I used to play, Desperado and sit there in silence, whilst, because any noise I make would come out on the microphone.
Sure.
I didn't have a thing to close the signal off. So, and then I got into mixes, and I've always been interested in sound design. And I still listen to the podcast, and it's called Coaster Radio. It's a very entertaining theme park podcast. I tend to stay away from the theater podcasts, purely because I don't want to be hugely influenced by what other people are doing. And I think to do a podcast and to listen to loads of other podcasts, it's quite hard. But I used to listen to the American Theater Week? Yeah, the American Theater Week.
Yeah, Downstage Center with Howard Sherman.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And I'm now friends with Howard on Facebook, and he writes he writes for The Stage here, actually, about what's happening in New York.
I've been emailing Howard for weeks trying to get him on here, and he's not responsive. So if you could drop in a word for me, I'd appreciate that.
I don't know him per se, but we're friends on Facebook. So. Yeah. I'm not a huge consumer of media because I'm not a perfectionist, but I find other production values tend to annoy me. It's very hard to find a highly produced podcast, which is what I'm very proud about as regards musical talk. But I know one of your questions that you want to ask me will lead to a major gaffe that we had once.
Sure. So tell us, have you had any big train wrecks?
It wasn't a train wreck, but it was something that I would go back into my DeLorean and change. We had Joey Herman on the show. And it was before I was able to understand he obviously didn't have Skype or anything like that. So his audio was terrible. And, you know, someone as important as Joey Herman, I'd love to go back and tighten that up a bit. And a dear friend of mine, Larry Hockman, who's an orchestrator at Adam's Family, and I think Something Rotten as well, and what was that, Camden Ebb, the Wonderful Scottsboro Boys, lots of shows. We had him on, and something went wrong where everything he said was echoed, and you can't go back and change those things. So once it's done, it's done. But it's all in, a lot of it is in the edit and how you fix it. And you know, things like you want to go back and you want to edit that cough out, or some episodes just haven't aired because they would be recorded, and then the publicist will decide, oh, we don't actually want that to go out. Can you wait? And then they never get back to you. And so, you know, we're still sitting on a Charles Strauss interview. No, sorry, not a Charles Strauss. I'll say that again. We're still sitting on a Sandy Wilson interview, which has never been allowed to go out, but now he's not with us. We might be able to get it out sometime. But it's interesting. Nothing terrible has happened. We've never had anyone storm out of interviews or anything like that.
We have one show that hasn't aired. because we had a technology train wreck on our side.
Right.
It's very, very sad. So I feel your pain in that, because it took a lot of doing to get the interview, and then nobody has ever heard it, and it's just sitting here on our hard drive. But you know, that's the thing, is that it's hard because you don't know what the quality of the audio is, if there is a problem, until you listen back to it. And being that how we do these things, you don't get to listen back until after the fact.
I mean, another thing I guess we change is we went through a bit of a change where we stopped playing music on the podcast. Mm-hmm. And I wish there was a worldwide rule that you could play 30 seconds of music and nothing more, and you'd be okay. But it's such a shame that there's still very tight draconian copyright laws around the world. And, you know, it'd be nice to... We play stuff now when we get permission, but in the early days when it was, you know, we were innocent and young, we just play any old thing. Nothing happened, of course.
Yeah.
But I just wish there was more clear rules as to what a podcaster who's not making money from a show is allowed to do.
Yeah, I mean, we spend, for Broadway Radio, we spend a few thousand dollars per year on BMI, ASCAP, and there's another group, CSAC or something like that, that are U.S.-based rights organizations, but it doesn't cover us outside of the United States.
Yeah.
And
the thing with podcasts is you're broadcasting to a worldwide audience.
Yeah. And then there's also, we take our podcasts and we convert them to audio shows on YouTube. And like we had the guys from Something Rotten on a few weeks ago, and we used some pieces from Something Rotten.
YouTube scanned it and said, nope.
Well, yeah, exactly. So what had happened was we got the music from the publicist, knowing that it was going to be played on the podcast, and we played it on the podcast and put it up on YouTube, and we got scolded, or a legal threat from YouTube because we played the music, and there's no facility to say we have permission to do this, and so the episode got pulled from YouTube, and surely the laws have not caught up with technology, and I don't have an answer to that. I don't know how that's going to work out in the end, but certainly I haven't even thought about what happens on the UK or EU side, because I think your copyright laws are much more strict than ours.
Possibly. I mean, I know you have the fair use policy in America, which we...
But fair use is wholly undefined. It's so ambiguous. So,
I mean, I was reading about it. I'm sure this must be very boring for listeners, and you can cut this out if you want, but I was reading about a podcast license, which you can get, which will cover you, but of course it's UK only, and the music publishers have to understand that the internet is not limited to the country you're doing it in. It's the world, and it has to change sometime. But, you know...
So are you...
And if this were a musical, there'd now be a song.
Yes, there'd be... You would start singing.
Yes. Well, I wouldn't, but...
tell me, where are you located in the UK?
I'm just in West London, so I can be in Theatre Land in about half an hour, which is lovely.
Oh, that's great. That's wonderful. Most New Yorkers consider New York the center of the universe.
Yep.
And
people in other countries think London is the center of the universe.
And that all of the United States revolves around New York, and our view of London is that London is the entire UK, but as you can attest, you know,
we don't all know the Queen, and we don't know your fifth uncle from
yes,
you're Welsh doesn't mean you're actually Welsh.
All right. Is there anything that I didn't ask you that maybe you wanted to let our listeners know about?
Just the usual web addresses and things, I don't know.
Yeah, tell us. You're on iTunes, as you said. Where else can we find you?
Well, we have the new website, which is musicaltalkpodcast.weebly.com. That will change. Or you can visit our old website if you want at musicaltalk.co.uk, which is a much better title. Usual Gavin's Twitter, twitter.com/musicaltalk, facebook.com/musicaltalk. Do listen if you haven't, because it's an interesting... as I said, it's an interesting history of the last 10 years of West End and beyond. We like to do operetta, cabaret, musical theatre. Tomorrow night, I'm actually going to the world premiere of the first ever theatrical stage show of Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Oh.
Which we'll cover on the podcast, because it will have live songs in it, improvised. We have Greg Proops and Colin Mockery and, you know, all the favourites and from that wonderful TV show. So we'd like to, you know, any excuse I can, go and see something and talk about it, we'll talk about it.
That's great. Well, if you get to New York, please look me up. And
I shall do.
When I get back to London, I will definitely look you up.
Yes.
So thanks for joining us, Nick. And
you're welcome, James.
And we will speak soon, okay?
Thank you very much. Have a lovely day. Have a nice day.